Today on the 21st, we're asking the question, can media outlets do a better job in diversifying newsrooms and covering critical issues like immigration?
There's always going to be some progress in sectors of the media, but we've got to look at the system overall. When I say I've given up on the legacy media, I've given up on their ability to perform themselves, not on the possibility of pressure being applied to them in the future in some other way to get them to change.
We talked to journalist Juan Gonzalez about politics, immigrants, and the media heading into the presidential election. Plus, Chicago hip-hop artist Bardo on his latest album, Gringo.
You thought I didn't know, but I knew. He don't do them things. Like
I'm Nyla Boodoo. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned.
Like you wish I was beside you, don't you? Because he don't do.
Listening to the 21st, I'm Nyla Boodoo. We've got a great show ahead of you for this Friday, including talking to the Chicago hip-hop artist Bardo. His new album, Gringo, is coming out later this week. But first, when asked about issues that are important to them in the 2016 election, 70% of registered voters say that immigration is, quote, very important to their vote. That's according to a Pew Research Center study from earlier this year. The number, by the way, gets even higher when you speak to Trump supporters. Juan Gonzalez has been reporting on issues of immigration, migration, migrants, and American politics for most of his career. Earlier this year, he retired after 29 years of writing a column for the New York Daily News. He still occasionally co-hosts Democracy Now! The veteran journalist was also one of the founders of the National Association of Hispanic Journalists. Juan Gonzalez is in Champaign this Monday for a talk he's giving on Monday afternoon to the University of Illinois' Global Diaspora and Migration Initiative. We've got him with us today ahead of that to give us a preview and talk about politics, immigrants, and the media ahead of this unprecedented presidential election. Juan, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Well, thank you. It's my pleasure to be here.
I wanted to start our conversation with something that Jose Antonio Vargas, another journalist that I know, said at a conference I was at recently. Jose was, for our audience who doesn't know, he was a Washington Post reporter when he, quote, came out as not having legal status in the U.S. His parents sent him here as a child without proper authorization. Jose runs a couple different projects now, and he said something at a conference I was at. He said the failure of Americans to understand their fellow immigrants in this country is something that he counts as an absolute journalistic failure. Do you agree with that?
Well, there's no doubt that the way that the most of the mass media have been covering the presidential campaign is almost as if there's never been controversy over immigration in the past, when it's exactly the opposite. Precisely because we're an immigrant nation, there have been periodic outbreaks of anti-immigrant fervor in the country. So this is nothing new, what's happened in the last 20, 30 years in terms of the vast Latino migration, especially from Mexico, but from other parts of the world. There's been many outbreaks from the anti-Irish, anti-immigrant fervor of the 1840s to the anti-Chinese hysteria in the 80s to the anti-Polish and Italian and Southern European migrations in the early 20th century. So this is really, it's basically a process that those who came a little while ago immediately paint those who came more recently as the problem. And it's precisely because we are an immigrant nation that we periodically have these national debates and battles over immigration policy.
And I think that when we
and
think
this is something mm-hmm. that and this is something that the news media never deals with, never puts it in a historical context of where the most recent outbreak, and especially now with Trump, is coming from.
Well, and I think when you think about that, what you think about whether things are being put into context or not, I think there are a couple pieces to this, right? Because it's not just how immigrants are perceived, but also, as you've said, reporting on immigrants and the role they play in the American economy. And I wanted to start with what you were saying about the context. What do you think is missing from the narrative right now about the context of the current situation that we're in?
Well, I think the biggest thing that's been missing is that, number one, that the United States is not alone in dealing with problems of undocumented immigration and of refugees coming to our border. There's basically a worldwide problem whether it's the most recent Syrian and African refugees and Afghan refugees coming into Europe, whether it's the long running Algerian, Moroccan, Tunisian migration to France, of Indians and Pakistanis and Jamaicans to England, of Turks to Germany. The reality is that since the end of World War II, the Third World has been coming to the West. And it's really the other side of globalization. As you break down borders for capital, you cannot expect that labor will continue to be kept within national borders. And so the reality is a combination of strife and wars in other parts of the world, and the huge wealth disparities between the advanced countries of the North and the global South means that migration has increasingly become a huge issue in all of these countries. So it's not the particular policy of one country versus another. It's really, we've got to deal with the other side of globalization. And we've got to be able to figure out a way to reduce the income inequality in the world so that fewer and fewer people will be forced to leave their homelands.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, do you think that we're telling those stories? Do you think that we're doing a good job of telling the stories people most affected by are of these people most affected by the news?
Well, here's the problem. I believe, unfortunately, that too many of my colleagues in the media these days think of history as going back a few days in somebody's Twitter feed, and they don't really have a deeper and a longer a sense of how the problems that we have today have developed. So we are contributing to the ignorance that is fueling a lot of these movements these days, especially the anti-immigrant movement, by our failure to provide a really reasoned understanding of immigration. And, you know, unfortunately, the Trump followers are fueled by ignorance, and they are not, and the media is not helping at all in terms of providing light rather than heat to the discussion.
Mm-hmm. When you think about the historical context, because we started this conversation with you talking about how we definitely have seen these cycles in American history in the past. And I wonder how you think we could be doing a better job covering, putting this in historical context.
Well, I think first of all, is the necessity to humanize the people that we are covering. There was some increase or some improvement in the coverage, I would say toward the 2007, 2008, after the vast immigration protests of 2006, you suddenly started seeing a much more nuanced approach to the coverage of immigration. And you had stories about the breakups of families, the reasons why people were leaving the countries from which they came, the conditions that they were facing. In other words, putting a human face on the migration problem. So I think that there was an improvement for a period of time. Unfortunately, we've relapsed now in the last couple of years now, as immigration became such a central issue of the Trump campaign. We've had a regression in the way that we deal with the problem, basically highlighting the most outrageous quotes and then the anger of people who feel that they're being victimized or targeted, but not really going into, well, what's the origins of this problem? How could it be resolved? What does comprehensive immigration reform mean? And I think that that's been lost now in what's essentially a battle over slogans, not over an understanding of the problem.
I'm speaking with Juan Gonzalez. He's a journalist. He's a broadcast journalist, an investigative reporter, a recently retired columnist for the New York Daily News. And I think that is a problem with the election in terms of how much it is, I guess, for lack of a better term, I don't know if horse race is the right word, what you would use to describe. I mean, how much of it do you think is just a representation of the fact that we're in a constant news cycle, that we're in a sense of information flowing every which way, and we have social media, we have all these different outlets for where people are getting information and not even being able to distinguish sort of where the sources of those information are coming from? Do you think that's part of the problem?
Well, there's no doubt that the public is drowning in so-called information. It's drowning in data, in commentary, in live reporting, but the level of the depth of understanding is not commensurate with the volume of stuff that's being thrown at us. So there is a disconnect, and I think that the disconnect is clearly that the most outrageous statements grab the most attention. Those that promote fear, anxiety, and insecurity will grab more eyeballs than those that try to resolve problems and come up with solutions and see a way toward more stability. So you're constantly, unfortunately, television, which is most of all concerned with ratings, and they can, you know, your average television show these days can tell, you know, within minutes of what particular segment of their show is drawing more eyeballs. And so if you want to draw more eyeballs, you've got to constantly churn up the audience and not necessarily provide the most reasoned and in-depth discussion. So I think it's the beast we have created that more information does not necessarily bring more knowledge.
When you think about that information as well, when you're one of the founders of the National Association of Hispanic Journalists, and there's a few major journalists of color professional associations that work to improve diversity in newsrooms across the country. And I wonder how much you also think it's important when we look at, first of all, I wonder where you think we're at. As someone who founded an NAHJ, do you think that for when we're talking specifically about Hispanic journalists, do you think that we're seeing enough diversity in newsrooms?
Well, it depends on how you define the newsroom. I recently spoke at the meeting of the American Society of Newspaper Editors, where I told them I'd basically given up on any substantive improvement in the legacy media, the mm-hmm. old media of radio, television, and print. Because basically they have not changed the composition of their newsrooms in the 40 years that I've been a working journalist. There's been no qualitative change. So it's, at this point, if they haven't done it in 40 years, they're not going to do it. What is even more upsetting is that the lack of diversity in new media, in online companies, in the Yahoos and Google Newses, you know, Google News and Yahoo News and all the other the new media is even worse. There's less diversity in the new digital media than there is in the old legacy media. Now, clearly, the new digital media are still growing, and they have a more of an opportunity to change. But the very same lack of integration of newsrooms that existed in the old media is now being replicated at an even greater extreme in the new media. So basically, I've reached the conclusion that they both part of the what happened with the old media, television and radio and print, was that in the 70s and 80s there was a massive in the aftermath of the urban rebellions of the 60s, there was a massive movement by communities to demand accountability by the broadcasters and the newspaper moguls. Just between between 1970 and 1973, there were 350 license challenges to the broadcast licenses of radio and television stations across America by community groups of African Americans and Latinos who demanded that they hire reporters, that they cover those communities better, and they challenged the licenses of the broadcast owners. So that's why you had the first whole generation of minority reporters get on television. The Ed Bradleys and the Connie Chungs and the Geraldo Riveras and all of those early folks who were hired in response to community pressure. The newspapers began diversifying their newsrooms, not out of the goodness of their hearts, but because the few Black and Latino reporters in those newsrooms began to file discrimination suits. The New York Times, the Washington Post, the Associated Press, they all faced racial discrimination suits. My own newspaper, the New York Daily News, was the only one to actually lose a federal discrimination lawsuit in court. And so as a result of the pressure of the communities and the lawsuits of those who were being discriminated against, the newsrooms of these old legacy companies began to open up somewhat.
Juan, can I stop you for a second? Because we need to take a break. But when we come back, we're going to pick up this conversation. Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. My guest is Juan Gonzalez. We've been talking to him. He's one of the founders of the National Association of Hispanic Journalists. He's actually going to be in Champaign on Monday. He's talking about the issue of migration and politics in the U.S. against the backdrop of this current presidential election. It's going that talk is at Monday at 4:30 at the university's main library. Juan, just before the break, we were just talking about, you said you've given up on having diversity in newsrooms. You were talking about the lawsuits and what's happened in sort of quote unquote legacy outlets. What do you think, if you've given up on sort of legacy outlets, what do you think about, what do you think about new media? And I'm thinking of companies like Fusion or other broadcast outlets that are trying to create, or I'm thinking of Al Jazeera America, sort of newer media outlets that are being created, or even Vice News. They just started their weekly, Vice News just started a new newscast on HBO in the past couple of weeks. Do you think they're doing a better job or not really?
Well, I think it's never a cut and dried situation. There's always going to be some progress in sectors of the media. Sometimes you get an enlightened owner or entrepreneur in one area who decides, well, you know, I'm going to really make an effort at diversity. But we've got to look at the system overall. When I say I've given up on the legacy media, I've given up on their ability to reform themselves.
Okay, that's a good point.
Not on the possibility of pressure being applied to them in the future in some other way to get them to change. But for them to continue to say, well, we're going to improve ourselves out of our own efforts, history tells you that's not happening. You know, and like I said before, it's worse in the digital media. Now, there's still the potential if communities organize, if they put pressure on especially the new media now, because clearly with the increasing diversity of the population, with the high percentage of usage by African Americans of Latino of digital media, especially mobile digital media, that I think that there is definitely much more of a potential pressure by those consumers on the producers of the information and data that they receive. But they have to be organized, and they have to know where to put the pressure, the proper points of pressure on the new digital media. So I think that, but for the companies to reform themselves, it's not going to happen in a substantial way. It may happen once in one particular company or for a little period, but they seem to always relapse back into status quo.
And those status quo, I mean, what do you think the implications are for that, of status quo, of having media that's not?
Well, what it means is that we're constantly receiving one-sided or shallow reporting on the issues and conditions that affect the African American, the Latino, the Asian American, Native American communities of the country. I mean, a perfect example is all of the stuff that's been going on with the Black Lives Matter movement. I mean, I'm stunned watching on television all these young reporters who act as if this is unprecedented, the level of racial conflict that's occurring right now as a result of police abuse and the conflict between non-white communities and police departments around the country, when in fact this has happened constantly.
To your mind, this hasn't. I mean, this is something in New York. You had a regular column with the New York Daily News. This is something for you. You've been reporting on for decades.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I covered the Los Angeles riot after the officers of the Rodney King beating were acquitted. You know, I was around in the a young person in the urban riots and disorders of the 1960s, and before my time, there were the rash of race riots in the United States in the 1940s, and there was another rash of racial conflicts after World War I, the Chicago race riot of 1919, the East St. Louis riot of 1917. Most of these were touched off by police abuse or by attempts by white groups or mobs to prevent African Americans from moving into their neighborhoods. Those were the main sources of most of the riots that have occurred in this country. So this is an old story in throughout American history. And the reporters that are reporting now are acting like this is shocking. It's not shocking. It's a recurrence of a problem that has not been solved. And I think that is that's the lack of context that we constantly see in the reporting on some of these issues.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm speaking with Juan Gonzalez. Juan, you're giving a talk next Monday at the University of Illinois on issues of migration and politics in the U.S. What context do you want to have in there? What do you think the main issues are within the current immigration system that need to be looked at?
Well, you know, there hasn't been a real overhaul of the immigration laws in this country since the Immigration Act of 1965. So we're talking about 50 years. 50 years the government has not tackled how people can come to this country and what are the proper limits, what do you do with guest workers, what do you do with the undocumented. I mean, there was an amnesty in the Reform Act of 1996, but that was a very limited act. It wasn't looking at the overall immigration policy of the country. So it's been over 50 years, and the country has changed dramatically as a result of immigration during that period of time. So the refusal of the leaders in Congress to look at an immigration overhaul in a complete sense of the word is really irresponsible because you know, it's not just a question of the undocumented. It's the question of what do you do about highly skilled workers. It's a question about what do you do with guest workers in agriculture. And it's a question of whether you continue to provide family reunification as a pillar of immigration policy, or you go for some other major pillars. There's lots of aspects to the to immigration reform that need to be addressed. And the people who say, well, we've got to build a wall first. Well, migration from Mexico, which is the main source of undocumented migration to the country, has dropped dramatically in the last several years. It's nowhere near the problem that it was 8 or 9 or 10 years ago. But there are still other problems that have to be dealt with in terms of immigration. And Congress continues to shirk the problem.
I wanted to place a conversation with you that we had on the 21st recently. We had her title is Chief Latina for Trump in Illinois on the program. She's Mexican-American. She shared the story of her mother coming here illegally and explained that's why she supported Trump. And that's why she says she wants to build the wall. I wonder if we could listen to that for a minute.
My mother actually came here illegally when she was pregnant with me. And she faced a lot of hardships because of it. She was working as a housekeeper, as a single mother. She did not obtain any government benefits because she was undocumented. She always had the fear of leaving me as a child with someone at daycare and finding out that she was undocumented. So most of the times I would have to go to work with her. And that's hard. That's hard being a child, being one, being two, having to go to work.
You were born here. So
and I was born here. Yes. So, yes, I was born here. So that was very hard, having to go with her to work and work for people that paid her very little money, that took advantage of her, that I no toddler should have to go through that. And I believe that if immigration, there is some kind of reform, these people that want to come here to better their life for themselves and their children, they'll find a way to legally come here so they don't have to go through what my mother had to go through and always live in fear.
That's Maria Vasquez. She's a chief Latina for Trump in Illinois, and that's why she says she supports building a wall. And I wonder, as you're listening to that, and we're thinking about, and I was also thinking about the fact Donald Trump is, we've seen polls saying he's getting about 20% support among registered Hispanic voters. Do you think it's because of sentiments like Maria?
Well, I think it's, I question whether he's going to be, whether Trump is going to get 20% of the Latino vote. I find that hard to believe. And maybe I'm just not in the right Latino communities in the country. But I think that it's probably going to be closer to the single digits than it is to 20%.
Okay.
I also think that the young woman obviously expresses some deep emotional scars from her own childhood as the child of an undocumented migrant. But I think there's a couple of disconnects in her viewpoint. One is, if I'm not mistaken, Trump has actually raised the issue of seeking to do away with birthright citizenship.
Correct. So,
mm-hmm. And her citizenship is birthright citizenship. And I think that because if a mother was undocumented, and then the other thing is that this idea that if you build a wall with Mexico, then people from Mexico will have to come here legally, does not really shows a lack of understanding of what is happening, what has happened with migration policy. The legal line of people waiting to come into the United States from Mexico today is 20 years. It's the same for people from the Philippines. It's the same for people from China, which are the main sending countries, because there are so many people coming from those three countries legally that they have to wait 20 years.
20 years. I just want to, you said that.
20 years. That's the length of the line. Why is that? Because the immigration reform of 65, which is the last time there was a major reform, established caps on migration from different countries. And they were basically equalized caps because they were trying to get away from the old European preferences of the last immigration overhauls in the 20s. So they tried to equalize it. So basically, even though Mexico, China, and the Philippines supply the bulk of the migrants coming to this country, they have caps similar to other smaller countries that don't have as many people coming. So there's been an artificially created cap system that then hurts people coming from Mexico, from China, and from the Philippines. So all the country would have to do is rewrite the laws to increase the caps to correspond more realistically to who are the countries, which are the countries that are sending people here, and suddenly people could get in faster, and they would not as many people would have to try to come in here illegally. So it's all a question. Because, the thing about immigration law.
Do you have a sense, Juan, do you think that all of that, and as you've explained that, I appreciate you laying all of that out. Do you have a sense that any kind of comprehensive reform will happen after all of the, everything we've gone through in the past couple of months, regardless of who the outcome of the presidential election?
I think it's inevitable.
Do you think it's more inevitable now?
Yes, and I think it will be inevitable after Election Day, because the attacks on immigrants that have emerged in this, not just by Trump, but during the Republican debates, by virtually all the Republican candidates, have, I believe, energized the citizens, who are immigrants, to a point that I believe they're going to come out in numbers that people have no idea, because they are the most energized at this point. I think that the foreign-born citizens of the United States today are probably more energized to come out to vote than the most diehard Trump supporters.
Interesting. So, do you think that we're going to see turnout levels that are going to be higher among not just Latinos but other immigrants across the U.S.?
Right. Yeah, I think so. That's my sense from covering these issues and talking to folks. There's much more of a sense among the foreign-born immigrant community, many of whom have undocumented members within their families, that this election is really a historic deciding point for the country, and that they've got to play their part. So I think that, and it's certainly true, I believe, among the young Latinos and the Dreamer generation and the people that they go to school with, that they understand what's at stake. And they're going to be highly energized, I believe, to come out to vote.
Juan, we just have about a minute left. I'm just wondering if there's anything else in terms of how you think voters, especially immigrants, if there are lessons you think people will take away from this election season.
Well, I always say on the immigration issue, we need more light, less heat. And if we can get away from all the yelling and screaming and actually analyze the problem, we can come up with a rational solution that everyone can live with. But if we keep thinking that immigrants are the problem rather than part of the solution that are really, I was in Northwest Arkansas a few months back. And I was surprised at the number of farmers and business people in Northwest Arkansas and these were white farmers and white business people who were saying that their communities have been renewed by the influx of Guatemalan and Mexican immigrants into Arkansas that have helped to rebuild their downtown areas, bring back commerce. So they have a completely different view in that part of the country than some of the stuff that we're hearing on the cable channels about how people feel about immigration. The reality is that migration brings the most resilient, the most hardworking of a population to the new country. And they can revive the country, not bring it down.
That's Juan Gonzalez, the journalist, the veteran journalist we've been speaking with from New York. If you are in the Champaign area on Monday, he will be addressing issues of migration and politics in the U.S. at 4:30 at the university's main library. Juan, thanks for taking the time to be with us.
Okay, thank you.
You're listening to The 21st.
Humble as a mumbo, lapped up in the back, rusty Cadillac, rolling up a jumbo. Gonna pass it back for my cataracts, rolling around in circles. Some Libras and some Virgos, just text, I bet your girl knows. Well, we can go to turn up tonight. Not a lot to speak on,
Just science in my cup, turning Missy up, trying to get my freak on. But nights like this are rough, none of it's enough, would it be a surprise?
That's Bardo. He's a Chicago hip-hop artist with plenty of ties to Central Illinois. Fans of the University of Illinois basketball team might recognize that name. His father, Stephen Bardo, was part of the Flying Illini team back in 1989 and had a long career that took him and his son all over the world, which is some of the inspiration for his latest album, Gringo. We just heard a little bit from there. It's going to be out next week. He's on the phone with us now from Chicago. Hey, Bardo, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah. So listen, your dad played basketball all around the world. And because of that, you spent time all over when you were a kid. How did that influence your development as an artist?
You know, it's kind of crazy. It really didn't. I didn't even really think about it. You know, as a little kid, you're just kind of like following your parents around and, you know, tagging along behind them. And obviously, you know, being somewhere like Japan, which is where I spent most of the time, like when I was living overseas, being somewhere over there that's that different, obviously, it's kind of shocking. And, you know, it's cool, but you're still just a kid. You're still, you know, you're growing up. So a lot of stuff is new. But honestly, it planted a seed that didn't really start sprouting until I was probably about, late teens, early 20s. And I just really started getting the itch to like reconnect back to, you know, to Latin American culture, to Spanish culture, to Japanese culture, all the things that I had experienced as a little kid that were kind of just like, you know, popping up in the back of my head, like, hey, remember this, remember that?
Yeah.
You know?
So what was it when you were a teenager? What was it about that thinking, hey, I've kind of lived this life as a global citizen, I should start paying a little bit more attention to it? Was it anything in particular?
I think it was going to college, for sure. That definitely helped, because that's kind of a mind expanding experience by itself. But you know, I had a lot of time to kind of sit and think about things, and you know, realize that, man, I kind of call myself a Chicago, and I grew up in Chicago for the most part. But you know, there's all these other experiences that I also have that were kind of just dormant there for a while, and they kind of started to manifest as I started to take this journey to kind of, you know, transform my style a little bit and reinvent myself. They just kind of started coming out on their own. It really wasn't a thing that I had to force a whole lot. It just kind of came out.
Well, and certainly, I guess in Chicago, Gringo is not necessarily a title somebody would have given you, right? So
right.
So that comes from that's the name of the album. I imagine that's from your time when you were in Brazil. Why did you remember that when you came back to the U.S.? Where did that come from?
I just knew I wanted my title to be either a word in Spanish or in Portuguese. And I threw around some titles that didn't really have a whole lot of meaning. They just kind of sounded cool. But when I went down to Brazil, I experienced a lot of stuff. But I remember being out with some friends, and they were saying, oh, we're going to, we're going to get the gringo drunk. We're going to, you know, like, they kept calling me gringo over and over. And I was like, what is that? Like, you know, like, and I was thinking of it from like the way what we think of as a gringo. And I was like, all right, really? Like, that's what you guys are calling me?
Yeah. But normally, I was going to say gringos are normally white, right? Is that what you mean by that?
Right. Exactly. That is exactly what I mean. And that's why I kind of like, you know, I was like, wait a minute, what are you guys talking about? And they were like, no, it doesn't mean that. It's not even really a bad thing. It just means you're a foreigner, you know?
Yeah, it's not a bad word, right?
Right. It's not the way, you know, the way we kind of think about it. So I was thinking, I kept hearing it, and it kind of stuck with me. And when I came back here, it was really like when the news really started picking up a lot of the, you know, police killing black people, like all that kind of stuff, all the like craziness that we're experiencing now that sadly is kind of a normal thing. That was right when it was starting to become, you know, a lot of news, and people overseas were starting to look at us. People in Brazil were asking me like, yo, what is going on with you guys right now? And I was like, you know what? I have no idea, honestly. And I kind of came back feeling like I was kind of a foreigner here as well. 'Cause you know, it's like, I mean, if we're not safe with the police, you know, we're killing one another. I mean, that's a whole other conversation, but you know, it's like, where can we feel safe in this country, you know? So that's kind of, I felt like a gringo back at home, to be honest.
Okay. I wonder if we can listen to another song off of Gringo. This one's called Do Them Things. It was the first single you released from the record earlier this year. Let's take a listen.
All right.
na 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 na. Woo! You thought I didn't know, but I knew. He don't do them things, do them things like I do, like I do. You wish I was beside you, don't ya? 'Cause he don't do them things like I do. Yeah, yeah, like I do. Yeah. Well, I'm checked out, you a no-show, and we both know that it's over. It's over. But he ain't home, and she gone too. I mean, it's on you. But come over, or I'm sober. And I ain't got no real excuse. I've been chilling, killing, dealing. Now my feelings getting loose. Been 6 months and 7 days, and girl, you still ain't got no proof. So instead of getting fed up, why don't you head up to my set?
You thought I didn't know, but I knew.
He don't do them things like I do. Like I do. So I know he don't do that thing like I do. Yeah, yeah, like I do. Yeah. Why is everything that's good for me just hurt so bad? Infatuation is amazing, but it sure don't last. That's one of them things that I learned post-grad. Appreciate when you got more than what most had. The way I see it, girl, you had just what I needed. That's why I spent 5 hours typing just to delete it. I wish that we could predict and prevent, put our names in the cement. But I guess that's just what we get. So slide through on a sneak tip. 'Cause baby, ignorance is bliss, and not to mention he you already know my weakness. So don't break me down, break me down, 'cause baby, you know how to do those. Do them things.
That's Do Them Things from Bardo. He's a Chicago hip-hop artist. His album with that track, Gringo, that's the name of the album, is coming out next week. We're talking to the Chicago artist now on the 21st. Bardo, you can hear a lot in there, right? And I wonder, I don't know if hip-hop is, because there's so much other influence. I mean, when you think about what genres influence you the most musically, it is a lot what we've been talking about, right? Because you hear a little bit of that Latin America, Brazilian beat in there. And musically, where do you think you draw the most influence from?
I tell a lot of people that in my head, I'm a neo-soul artist. And like, that's not true at all if you listen to my music, but I feel like I draw inspiration from like the spirit of neo-soul probably the most. Just that real groovy, like, you know, at times kind of syrupy, like, you know, vulnerable lyrics, just like very, very groove heavy, very funky, very, you know, I've always loved that live instrumentation and music and all that. So that's probably where I would say I draw the majority of my inspiration from. I mean, it comes from all over, but that's kind of at the core of what I've been doing.
As you're going around touring, is one of your goals to be playing also back in Japan or Brazil and places that you've lived before?
Oh, absolutely. That is something I write down pretty much every day. I got a list of goals that I write down, and tour UK, tour Japan, tour Latin America, tour Australia. Those are all on that list for sure. So it's funny that you say that. I just actually got done writing that down not too long ago.
All right, good. I'm reading your mind. How do you think, yeah. I wonder how this album is technically your third release, but you said it feels like your debut. What do you mean by that?
You know, it's just everything about this project is different, and I'm not saying that in the cliche, like, oh, this is my best work ever, you know, but just the way that I approach doing this project, from the album art to the production to the recording to just kind of coming up with like arranging the song, it was all much more collaborative than what I had been doing in the past. In the past, I I worked with my very best friend, Antonio Robles, and it was just he and I, and we just locked in a room and we made all the beats, and I would write the lyrics, and then we went and recorded, and he made the album artwork and we put it out. And that was awesome because that was, you know, a shared experience between the two of us that like will always be super special to me. But I think with this one, I met James Trikler. Shout out to James Trikler, you know, down in Champaign, and he really introduced me to Church Booty and Emily Otness and Fiona Kimball and Cela Cole and all these like amazing artists down in that CU scene that I had no idea were even there, even though I went there. You know, I went to U of I, but I had no idea that scene even existed. So a lot of what you hear is just collaboration, and it to me it kind of sounds like it. It's like all these different ideas kind of running into one another. And even with the album art, I worked with a guy named Alex Ashford out of Miami, and just an incredible visual artist and graphic designer. So I felt like I kind of humbled myself, because before it was like, you know, we got this, we can do this all on our own, we don't need anybody. And this time around, I was kind of more like, man, let's see who's out there. Let's see what these other people can bring to the table. And I think I'm happy with how it's turned out.
And Pardo, it's interesting you say that, because you're talking about collaboration. And I wanted to just go back to something you said at the beginning about the whole notion of the album being called Gringo, and how much that is a little bit of experience you feel like, as not just a reflection of your international experiences you've had growing up, but coming back to the U.S. as a Black man. Do you feel like this album is really reflective of that, of where you sort of see your place in the world right now?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. One of the things that was different about this album and kind of the way I approached it was, it's pretty simple. I mean, in with the past two projects, I literally sat down and wrote my lyrics down, and this one I didn't really do that as much, and not in a bragging way or anything like that, but it was just kind of how I did it. I would just stand in front of the mic and just kind of let whatever was on my mind at the time roll off and come out of my mouth, and that's kind of what I would try to stick with those main themes that would come out. And most of the time it did deal with kind of being a Black man and you know, what I see around me, how I feel, whether I feel safe, whether I don't, whether I'm hopeless, discouraged, you know, feeling positive. It kind of all comes through, and I feel like that was really a big tool for that, just kind of letting my subconscious mind kind of go crazy a little bit.
Gringo will be out next week. You can get it on Apple Music, Spotify, all those places. I want to thank Bardo. Let's listen to one last song to take us out. This one's called Backstroke. Hey, Bardo, thanks for being with us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It was great.
Humble as a mumbo, laughed up in the back, rusty Cadillac, rolling up a jumbo. Going and pass it back for my cataracts, rolling around in circles. Some Libras and some Virgos. Just text, I bet your girl knows. But we can go to turn up tonight. Not a lot to speak on. Just science in my cup, turning Missy up, trying to get my freak on. But nights like this are rough, none of it's enough. Would it be a surprise if I was gone by sunrise? It's early in our young life, but I should tell you one time tonight that I want you to know that I'm thinking about you wherever I go. But that don't mean I'm coming back, no. That don't mean I'm coming back, no.
Nyla Boodoo, The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.